It's Wednesday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, a century of partnership. President Obama says the United States has embarked on a long journey with Vietnam.
There's a skepticism across America about these trade agreements. We've also paid a heavy price in American manufacturing jobs going overseas.
As President Obama talks trade in Asia, lawmakers in Washington say a massive trade deal is stuck. Mystery shrouds the Egypt air crash, and country music loses another icon. All coming up on International Edition. President Barack Obama, in a forward-looking speech, has told the Vietnamese that they and the American people are embarking on a 100-year journey together.
So I come here mindful of the past, mindful of our difficult history, but focused on the future.
The speech also touched on the very sensitive topic of human rights, including freedom of speech and the press, as well as the rights to freedom of assembly.
They're written into the Vietnamese Constitution, which states that citizens have the right to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and have the right of access to information, the right to assembly, the right to association, and the right to demonstrate. That's in the Vietnamese Constitution.
Mr. Obama also mentioned the role of women in Vietnamese society.
Strong, confident women have always helped move Vietnam forward. And the evidence is clear. I say this wherever I go around the world. Families, communities, and countries are more prosperous when girls and women have an equal opportunity to succeed in school and at work and in government. That's true everywhere, and it's true here in Vietnam.
The president spoke of opening Vietnam's political process to candidates from outside the Communist Party. VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman monitored President Obama's speech while he was in Bangkok and shared his thoughts with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
What's in the Constitution is not how things are on the streets, and we saw an example of this today. One of the dissidents who was supposed to meet with the president said earlier in the day he was forced into a car by police, driven out of Hanoi and detained for 5 hours to prevent him from meeting with the U.S. president. And if you talk to activists outside the country, they will tell you that despite the characterization that President Obama gave of some quote-unquote modest progress on human rights, they believe that there's been little or no progress in Vietnam, and they're quite disappointed with the stance by not only the Vietnamese government, but by how the United States has, in their eyes, soft-pedaled all this today.
The president was able to meet with some Vietnamese civil society members, as they're called. How did that go?
Well, he did note that several other activists who were invited were prevented from coming, as he put it, for various reasons. The president said that there are significant areas of concern, and he praised those members of civil society who have been willing to make their voices heard.
Did the president touch on the issue of the Vietnam War?
Yes, he did, although I would describe the bulk of his speech today as forward-looking rather than delving on the past. He did, at the beginning, note that there is a war monument in Hanoi, which mentions that 3 million Vietnamese soldiers and civilians died in the war between the United States and South Vietnam versus North Vietnam. And he praised Secretary of State John Kerry, who was in the audience, saying that he had been at the forefront of, as a war veteran, of bringing this relationship forward.
Well, you've spoken about how the human rights activists have responded. What is the government's response to the president's address today?
We haven't seen any official statement that has come out now. There were some Vietnamese government officials that were in the audience, and I did not get to see the looks on their faces when the president was mentioning this fairly sensitive topic. But he's saying, you know, it's time to look forward in the bilateral relationship, and that, you know, there are going to be disagreements on human rights and other issues. But hopefully that this is the beginning of a 100-year journey together, as he put it.
President Obama, on his first visit to Vietnam, gave his hosts a present that they had been hoping for, a total lifting of the U.S. embargo on sales of lethal weapons. Mr. Obama denied the removal of the ban was tied to increasing concerns about Beijing's military activities in the disputed South China Sea. However, China's Global Times tabloid, which is run by the Communist Party in its Tuesday edition, said Obama's assertion that lifting of the arms ban was not tied to containing China was a lie. President Obama headed next to Ho Chi Minh City, formerly known as Saigon. There, the focus shifts to trade with a speech to business leaders and entrepreneurs. We'll have more on the trade issue coming up on International Edition. Right now, it's time to check out what's trending online. To do that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is right here in the studio to talk about the latest study by the Pew Research Center. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, I have to be honest, why are we talking about a research report?
Well, it sounds boring, but it is actually trending very big on Twitter and Facebook. That's because for the first time in more than 130 years, American adults are more likely to be living with their parents as opposed to with a spouse or a partner. Specifically, we're talking about Americans aged 18 to 34.
Oh, wow. Well, as the saying goes, get a job.
Well, okay. Well, to their defense, I would say living with their parents as an adult is not viewed positively by many here in America, but that may be a totally American concept. Let's check out one of the most liked comments to Pew's Facebook post about the latest study. A man named Vishal wrote, "Moving out after you are a quote-unquote adult is really a Western thing. I don't know why there is such a stigma surrounding living at home. You can help your parents, they can help you. Communal living has a lot of benefits." The top comments were mostly about defending the growing trend of living at home. Another person wrote, "I've been criticized for it as if I never left, but I don't mind. I love spending time with my family and being able to help out when I can."
Well, I'm sure there were some negative responses.
There were. Actually, some still pointed out that at 18, some people are still in high school. And also a user named Steven wrote that he lived on his own since he was 16 and his son when he was 19. He argued that being independent early on in life builds your character, and that invited a lot of interesting counter-arguments. People were telling him to get informed about current macroeconomic situation and that the 70s were quite a different economic time.
Wow. Well, gee, I know you grew up in Asia, mm-hmm. a little bit of a different perspective. How is it viewed there?
Well, actually, in many parts of Asia, living on your own before getting married suggests either you have a not-so-great relationship with your parents, so you want to just get out of there, or that you're a bit of a hippie. It's actually viewed quite negatively, especially if you're the eldest child who is supposed to be taking care of your parents. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you so much for that insight and analysis, G. How does your society view an adult living with his or her parents? Let us know by tweeting your comments to @VOA_IE. You may also tag myself and G on those tweets. We are @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia. Taliban preparing ground for leadership transition. At least 12 dead, 50 injured in jade mining landslide in Myanmar. Bank linked to 1MDB scandal probed in Singapore and Switzerland. North Korean restaurant workers seek asylum in South. China using tourism as economy and foreign policy tool. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website, voanews.com, and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. While President Barack Obama promotes trade opportunities between the United States and Asia, U.S. senators of both political parties say there is virtually no chance Congress will approve the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the near future. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that the pact would reduce trade barriers among 12 Pacific nations that account for 40% of global economic output.
Speaking in Vietnam Monday, President Obama said he is confident TPP will pass Congress. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had this reaction to the president's prediction.
Somewhere between delusional and overly optimistic. There's been a sourness on trade.
Democrat Dick Durbin noted America's remaining presidential contenders, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, all oppose TPP.
There's a skepticism across America about these trade agreements. We've also paid a heavy price in American manufacturing jobs going overseas, so that skepticism is well placed.
Mark Warner is only one of a handful of Democrats openly backing TPP.
Yeah, there are winners and losers in every trade deal. But the irony is a lot of this dislocation, particularly vis-a-vis trade with China, has already taken place, and TPP doesn't even deal with China.
TPP supporters are holding out hope for congressional votes after the November elections in what is known as the lame duck period before a new president is sworn in. Even then, there are no guarantees. Asked about TPP's chances, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer said, quote, "It's a tough lift." Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Conflicting reports emerged from Egypt Tuesday regarding whether or not an explosion caused an Egypt Air passenger plane to crash into the Mediterranean last week. The Airbus A320 jet was on a flight from Paris to Cairo when it plunged into the sea May 19th with 66 people on board, most of them Egyptians and French citizens. Searchers from Egypt, France, and other nations have found small pieces of debris and human remains, but not yet the main wreckage or flight data recorders. The security implications of the crash are the topic of this week's hashtag VOA TV program. Host Michael Lippin is with me in the studio now to tell us about it. Michael?
Thank you so much, Jim. Well, those conflicting reports that you mentioned came from Egyptian forensics officials. One unnamed officer was quoted in Western media today as saying, "The discovery of only small body parts so far suggests that a blast happened on the plane." But you know, hours later, the head of Egypt's forensics authority went on record as saying that is just speculation. Well, that back and forth came up in my conversation with aviation analyst John Rose, the chief operating officer of iJet International, and with Mideast analyst Michael Hanna of the Century Foundation, who joined us via Skype from New York. I asked Rose what he thinks of the way Egypt has been handling the investigation so far.
What seems to be they're conducting it according to their protocols and in a very professional manner. These situations are extremely difficult to deal with. Every country has different ways they go about handling this, of course, with international assistance. They seem to be handling it very well. The most troubling part are some of the misinformation that comes out in the media. They allow certain people to speak on things that they probably shouldn't be mentioning. I know there was a report earlier, someone from Egypt said, well, there's not even any body parts large enough to identify.
This was an unnamed forensics official,
right?
Apparently.
They don't need to be saying things like that because that's just, it's damaging to the family members who are trying to find out what happened to their loved ones and claim them, and those type of statements are not relevant to the investigation.
Well, Michael, what do you make of some conflicting reports that we have coming out from Egypt about the investigation into this?
Well, I think there are conflicting reports not just from Egypt. There's conflicting reports from Greek authorities and others. It's a very sketchy picture, and we are seeing numerous leaks that are in direct contradiction to each other. I think it is problematic for the investigation. It's not surprising that it's happening, but it is leading to a lot of second guessing about protocols in place and about the investigatory process. I should add that there's been a lot of frustration in previous incidents with the performance of Egyptian authorities, their transparency and professionalism. And so for Egypt, I think it is a really high priority that they seek to conduct as transparent and professional a process as possible in light of that past history.
Well, Michael, how would you compare the professionalism of those Egyptian investigators to the way Americans go about dealing with such incidents?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't have technical expertise in terms of the airline industry and aviation authorities. What I can say is that if we compare it to the performance around the Metrojet downing, there is an apparent difference in attitude. There has always been this frustration with the Egyptian authorities, a sense that there was obfuscation at play, and a less than transparent process that wasn't actually aiming to get to a kind of ground truth conclusion. And so it does appear, and of course the circumstances are different. This plane left from France, and I think that does have an impact on the way that the Egyptian authorities have approached the issue. But it does appear that the Egyptians are being more forthcoming than in the recent past.
Well, John, just quickly, why do you think we are getting a little more transparency from Egypt this time compared to Metrojet?
I think it's the issue of the impact to the country, both economically from tourism and also international pressure. They didn't handle the last investigation very well. They weren't very transparent. They have to be more transparent this time because it's having a crippling effect upon the reputation of Egypt and the willingness of travelers, business and leisure, to go there.
Well, for more of that conversation, you can watch the full show at www.voanews.com/#VOA. And let us know what you think about the Egypt Air crash by commenting on our #VOA Facebook page and our Twitter account. Jim?
Michael Lippin, thanks for stopping by, and do check out the #VOA program. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Country music has lost one of its great singer-songwriters, Guy Clark. He died after a long illness at the age of 74. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk of Clark's legacy and impact.
Nikki, tell us about Guy Clark.
Well, Guy Clark was many things. He was a prolific singer, songwriter, and musician who did both country and folk music. He also built guitars as well. He was called a songwriter, a poet's poet, who wrote many a hit for the who's who in country and Americana music, including Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, Alan Jackson, George Strait, to name a few. Roseanne Cash said she would not be the songwriter she was if she hadn't sat at his table and learned from a master. Many called him a king of Texas songwriters. He was one of the great Texas troubadours, and he has the recognition and awards to back that up. He was elected to Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004. In 2005, the Americana Music Association honored him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2014, he won a Grammy for Best Folk Album for My Favorite Picture of You. And I think this is really cool. In 2011-2012, a slew of country artists, including Willie Nelson, Roseanne Cash, Lyle Lovett, Vince Gill, paid tribute to his work in a Grammy-nominated double album set of songs he wrote or co-wrote, and it was called This One's for Him.
Oh, well, he also substantially contributed to the progressive country and outlaw country genres of music that developed in the 70s.
Yes, Sarah. Now, progressive country came out of songwriters rebelling against mainstream Nashville sound. A lot of these genres are, rebelling against Nashville. For progressive country, it came out of songwriters' desire to write for themselves, as opposed to just, like, churning out hits. They were also influenced by rock music at the time. They were impacted by influential singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and much of the political discourse of the 1960s. And then progressive country laid the groundwork for outlaw country, which continued to rebel against the commercialization of the Nashville sound and its very clean-cut image at the time. And musically, it drew upon rock and roll as well as honky-tonk and rockabilly. And Guy Clark was very active in both genres.
Even though Guy was a great singer-songwriter, he didn't have the same success as those who recorded his music.
I know, and it's kind of ironic, but not uncommon for that to happen. Guy's recordings of his own songs didn't have the same commercial success. Johnny Cash was one of the first major artists to cover his songs. I know in 1975, he covered the last Gunfighter Ballad. Then later on, Cash did Desperado's Waiting for a Train as a member of the country supergroup, The Highwaymen, which included Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Waylon Jennings. And that became a huge hit. And what I find to be funny is he wrote this song called L.A. Freeway, which a lot of artists have covered. It's inspired by the time he spent in L.A. in his early search for fame and fortune before he moved to Nashville. And in the song, he says, if I can just get off this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught. That's like, and he said after the famous O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, it took him years to be able to sing that line without breaking into laughter. You know, talk about singing about truth. And he also joked that he might have won a Grammy sooner, but he kept losing out to Bob Dylan.
Well, it sounds like he had a great sense of humor.
Yeah. And his narrative rich songwriting, filled with great metaphors and photographic images, really made him one of the most respected singer-songwriters of his generation.
Well, you can hear more music from Guy Clark and other great country singers and songwriters on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you have any comments, suggestions, or even requests, you can reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados waiting.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our thanks go to director Tracy Carter and engineer Zainab Abdelrahman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Most of all, we thank you for spending time with us. Come back when you can and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé welcomed students from the International Marketing and Regional Integration Programs of the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, or IRIC, to the James Baldwin Information Resource Center, or IRC, to acquaint themselves with the functioning of the center and to have access to relevant sources for their academic research work. The James Baldwin Information Resource Center is a component of the Public Affairs section of the U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé. It is a public lending library for students, academia, and the general public, and a reference research center which provides comprehensive and authoritative information on the United States. Embassy Affairs Officer Roberto Quiroz II congratulated the students on their admission into such a prestigious institution as IRIC. This is an effort the United States of America is proud to offer Cameroon in a support role, he said. The real credit for all efforts go to Cameroon and Lake Chad Basin nations because they are leading all security efforts. All Cameroonians must be proud of how their sons and daughters in uniform have not hesitated to defend their homeland and fellow citizens against Boko Haram's attacks, which have victimized innocent civilians and targeted women and girls. Mr. Quiroz said Boko Haram will be defeated so that Cameroonians can build a future of peace and prosperity through their own talents and ideas. He also underscored other areas of partnership between both nations, including the protection of refugees fleeing violence, U.S. support for a vibrant civil society, growing private sector to create jobs, and a free media, and joint efforts to protect wildlife. Mr. Quiroz also explained how diplomacy is an instrument of advancing good governance goals, adding that public perception of their performance as IRIC students and future diplomats and civil servants is very important as well. Congratulations on your achievements, he told the students. As future leaders in your fields, your first and foremost priority will be to advance the interests of Cameroon. That is a great responsibility. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Cameroon, for the benefit of both nations, the region, and Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.